Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Girl, real talk. This whole, it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
I'm as confused as anyone about what anything is, you know, and I'm open to pretty much any explanation. And so there's something that happens in the writing that isn't just my intelligence, you know what I mean? That isn't just my knowing or my ego.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. To keep everyone safe, these interviews were recorded remotely, usually on a cell phone in somebody's home, and so you might hear some sounds and signs of life, like a car backfiring, a dog walking through the room, usually my dog walking through the room. Thank you for your patience with that. This episode of Thresholds is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe. Every day, Mubi premieres a new film by iconic directors or emerging auteurs. There's always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime and anywhere. The selection is really so incredibly good, from modern classics like First Cow and Nomadland to 1960s masterpieces from Japan and France and Brazil, Norway. I'm always discovering something new and wonderful there. You can try Mubi free for 30 days at Mubi.com/thresholds. That's Mubi.com/thresholds for a whole month of great cinema for free. Kaveh Akbar is a poet and the author of two collections of poetry, including Calling a Wolf a Wolf and his most recent Pilgrim Bell, which is out August 3rd. He's also the poetry editor of The Nation. His poems have been published in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Paris Review, Best American Poetry. And he came to talk about the process of getting sober and using poetry to help him save his own life. He also talks about why he thought of calling his most recent collection, Pilgrim Bell, God. Hope you enjoy.
I was 24. I was actually young. I was something of a prodigy of debauchery. I had within a month of having my first drink of trying alcohol for the first time, I had also tried heroin for the first time, and it was just off to the races at that point. You know, it never really slowed down until it all stopped completely. I was 24. So if I don't screw up between now and July 12th, I'm not sure when this is coming out. Maybe it already is July 12th when people are listening to this, but if I don't screw up between now and then, it will be 8 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you tell me about, like, I don't know, the months or the year leading up to your decision to get sober?
Yeah. I mean, my first book was largely an addiction recovery narrative. So none of this stuff is like, I feel like I've pretty like, I'm not super shy about talking about this stuff, being as how I sort of wrote a book about it and thrust it into the world. But I was living on a mattress in a house that got burgled and robbed all the time because I sold drugs. And I just had like a pile of clothes and a mattress on the floor to my name. And I had, I had broken several bones. I'd shattered my pelvis. I'd had run-ins with law enforcement and various degrees of severity. But when I actually ended up sort of lurching towards help, it was kind of a day like any other, you know, but none of the things that seem superficially or externally like they should be bottoms, were the things that actually got me to sort of crawl my way towards help. And I don't know. To this day, I don't exactly know what it was that did that catalyzed that motion. You know, when I did crawl my way towards help, it was slow and clumsy and imperfect, but I hung around and the people around me were really, really graceful, literally like full of grace. I think about grace a lot. This is something that I have spoken with Les, transcendent American prose writer, Leslie Jameson, who is a mutual friend of ours. We've talked about this idea of grace a lot, and the idea of grace, the inherent quality of grace that differentiates it from things like propriety or kindness, being that grace is unearned, right? Like if you are the beneficiary of grace, it means that, if you've earned it, it's something else. It's like, it's propriety or it's kindness or it's justice, right? But to show grace to somebody, I feel like that means that that's a person who can do you no good or who has done you no good, right? And I was the beneficiary of so much grace from so many people to whom I could do no good. I found, I was suddenly, not to put too fine a point on it, but I was very much at this sort of threshold, at this sort of Rubicon. And on the other side of it was this amazing life where I get to be a poet, but I was just trying not to die. I was very unhyperbolically trying not to die. I found out a year into my sobriety, I got a physical for this job that I was trying to get at the time. And I found out that my liver a year sober was still pre-cirrhotic, which I didn't even know it was pre-cirrhotic, a year prior when I got sober. But the liver is one of those weird organs that can kind of heal itself like a lizard's tail, which is to say that a year prior, when it showed up as pre-cirrhotic at that physical, this was after a year of healing, which is to say that a year prior, it very likely was at some kind of Rubicon, across which there would be no return.
Wow.
And so not to be too dramatic about it, right? But figuring out what the source of that awareness was, that sort of brought me to my knees, and in so doing allowed me to crawl to help. Whether it is, there are sorts of biological intelligences, right? When you hear about say like a woman who is deficient in iron will sometimes crave dirt, right? This has like been documented, right? Or like a pregnant woman who is deficient in iron will sometimes crave dirt because there's iron in the dirt, and it's not because there's like a conscious awareness, but it's because there's like a kind of like biological intelligence that there exists iron and dirt. And there are other, soap eating. There are these different kinds of biological intelligences. And so it may be that something sounded through my dense sort of narcotic fugue to say, like, if you don't fix this now, you're not going to be able to later. It could be a more sort of metaphysical, cosmological thing. And I don't know. I mean, sometimes it heebies people's jeebies when I talk about that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is that I'll never know, you know, I'll never know which side of it it's on, but it's really interesting to me.
Yeah. If it's okay to ask, what were the first days and weeks of sobriety like for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for holding this with care and generosity. Jordan, I know that it's not, sort of a weird thing to be talking about with a relative, you know, it's, you know, we haven't spent a lot of time together corporeally, or at all, you know? And so, but I appreciate you holding this with care and grace. It's useful to talk about it both, both for me and, you know, it was other people talking about this sort of stuff that made me realize that it was possible, to live another way. But, the first days of sobriety were totally white knuckling, just trying, like literally trying not to, you know, accidentally kill myself, which is a intense thing to say, but I mean, it's literally true. Like I couldn't sleep at all. You know, the walls were all walling, the towels were all toweling, you know, like, I was, if when you say hallucinating, people are like, oh, so you saw like a pink elephant riding a circus ball or whatever, you know, and that's not, but you know, it was like things were moving that weren't moving, you know, and it was just like a really sort of, ginger tender time going through physical withdrawals, because I was withdrawing from a lot of other stuff too. It wasn't just alcohol was sort of my drug of choice, but in any given moment I was on a whole bouquet of different narcotics. I went from that when the physical withdrawal symptoms abated a bit, I suddenly just had, you know, 18 hours a day to fill, right? Like my whole life was predicated on narcotic pursuit, you know, going to meet this guy so that I could trade this drug for that drug, or, you know, sling this drug for cash so I could buy drugs. You know, I had this whole economy set up around my addiction, which also involved, you know, working jobs that I got fired from a lot. At the time. Yeah. And so I suddenly had 18 hours a day to fill with something else. And so my first year of sobriety, I started a website where I, just sort of cold called or cold emailed poets and like begged them to talk to me for this website so that I could just like sort of interview my heroes. That became this website called Dive Dapper, which still exists online. I handed over the reins a few years ago, but I think there are 70 something interviews that I did in the first few years of my sobriety, just so that I would like, literally, like I would, you know, read everybody's bibliography, that I talked to, and then talk to them and then transcribe the interviews and then, you know, code them into the site and then put them out. And we did one interview every 2 weeks. And so that took a ton of my time in early sobriety, which is what I needed. I just needed something to take up the hours in the day, you know. I also played tournament backgammon for a while. I became like one of the top ranked players in the state of Indiana at backgammon, and I would travel to other states for tournaments for a while. I haven't played tournament backgammon in years, but I'm still pretty good at it. But you know, it was just something that, like, chess was like the delta between me and the very best in the world was like way too wide, and I would never be able to, you know, traverse it. And so, but backgammon was something that, like, you know, I could learn much quicker, and because of, you know, there are orders of magnitude fewer serious backgammon players in America than there are chess players. And so that was something that I could actually sort of But I think this is the thing, you know, like Roxanne Gay is like a really highly ranked Scrabble player. You know, I think there's like a thing where the, like there are a lot of secretly sort of competitive righty people in the world. And so that took a lot of time. You know, I just read backgammon theory books and play different scenarios against my computer and go to these tournaments. Just truly anything that could like fill my time. And then just reading poems and writing poems. I mean, more than anything else was just a physical place to put my body. You know, if I was writing a poem, that was 2 or 4 or 6 hours where I didn't have to worry about accidentally killing myself. You know, that was like, you know, maybe a third of the day that I just didn't have to figure out how to fill with something that wouldn't hurt me, you know? And that was like what the utility of poetry was for me for a long time. That's still one of my favorite things that a poem can be, is just a place to put yourself. You know, I think that we don't talk enough about that, right? It's just like, or a book, you know, it doesn't have to be a poem. I've been reading a ton of novels lately. Just like inhaling them. And it's just like, I've just been spending all my time and I've just been traveling a lot, you know, over quarantine. I was just like traveling all the time. It sounds corny to talk about like that, but I mean, it's true, right? Like I was corporeally trapped, but I didn't feel as spatially suffocated maybe because of it. Does that make sense? I feel like I'm sounding like a Reading Rainbow episode or something now.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. That's a hard thing to talk about without sounding like Reading Rainbow, but I think that that's one of the core things that attracts people who love to read and then love to write to both of those things.
Yeah.
Is the feeling like you can be outside of yourself and bigger than yourself and somewhere else when you're like in the poem or in the book.
Yeah.
The last year has been rough for everybody. People have been dealing with isolation, anxiety, grief, so much more. And even though our circumstances are beginning to shift a little bit, there's still a lot to process. Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform that has thousands of licensed therapists trained in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. Your therapist can help you set and achieve your goals. And as a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code Thresholds to get $100 off your first month and to show your support for the show. That's Thresholds and Talkspace.com. The code Thresholds to get $100 off your first month to match with a licensed therapist today and set and achieve your goals.
Yeah, and I mean, like, even the most skeptical, I mean, you're a writer and, you know, I mean, you I'm sure can relate to the phenomenon of just like sitting at the notepad or the notebook or the laptop. Are you a digital writer or a hand pen writer?
It sort of depends. Pen, but then typing is faster. So,
yeah, sure.
But
sure.
Pen is better for thinking, I think.
Totally. Yeah. I like to do first drafts with pen, like to do the thinking with the pen, right? And then like the first sort of editing happens when I put it into the computer. And then I feel like the computer just makes things look too, like I can write a bad poem in a computer and it'll still kind of look good, you know? Like it'll still kind
of because you've sort of typeset it already.
Yeah. There's serifs. It just kind of makes it look like a poem is supposed to look. You know what I mean? Whereas like if it's like just in my scrawl on like a legal pad or something, you know, the words really better be doing the work because the legal pad certainly isn't doing it any favors. I don't know. I don't know. This is a particularly neurotic digression, but just to say, like, you know, even the most skeptical writers in the world, the most sort of feet on the ground writers in the world talk about the process of writing by using language like, the time just flew by, the hours just flew by, or they'll say like such and such a phrase just came to me, right? They'll mine mm-hmm. the language of the supernatural to talk about what's happening, right? Like, and I'm not the most skeptical anything, you know, I'm as confused as anyone about what anything is, you know, and I'm open to pretty much any explanation. And so, Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's something that happens in the writing that isn't just my intelligence, you know what I mean? That isn't just my knowing or my ego, right? There's some other thing. I mean, what's your relationship to that? Like, how do you feel about that? Do you think it is like just you synthesizing everything that you've ever thought into like a more cogent and prosaic presentation?
It doesn't feel that way to me a lot of the time. And I don't know if the moments when it feels like there's something other than just my intelligence at work, and by my intelligence, I just mean like my mind, not like intelligence.
No, sure.
I don't know if it's that actually my mind is a vast terrain unknown to me, capable of producing things that my conscious mind wouldn't necessarily predict or understand, if it is sort of a more, I don't know, cosmic or ephemeral thing that's happening. But I definitely don't have the experience of like, I sit down to write and I write the things that I planned to write and I knew in advance what they were and how they were going to, you know, like I find writing to be a process of discernment and of divination. Like things come up in writing that I didn't know that I knew.
You were about to say divination.
I was about to say divination.
You were about to say it and then you sprinted away from it. Why'd you sprint away from it?
You know, I feel like I don't want to, I'm somebody who often writes about religion or the spiritual. It's like a big interest of mine and a love of mine. And one of the things that I find... Same. Yeah, I know. And one of the things that I find worrying is the way that sometimes people who write about those things can be dismissed as like not smart, not logical, not, but you know, like as unintelligent as like people who have suspended intelligence in favor of the spiritual. When I actually think that both of those things work in tandem, but I often censor my own language when I'm talking about things like that, because I worry about how I'll be heard, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
but maybe I should just say, fuck it and be like, well, let's just say divination.
Yeah, I mean, I do the same thing. That's why I was interested in it, because I sensed the simpatico in that moment, because I find myself doing the same thing. I may have already done it in this conversation at some point, but that reflexive sort of hesitancy to embrace in a rhetorical way the unknowing that we feel and sense in our work, and maybe even move towards. I don't mean to be speaking in the first person plural. I don't mean to speak for you, but the uncertainty that I'm really trying to court in my work is really feels load bearing to me. But for whatever reason, when I have conversations like this, my brain wants to talk about it as if I know anything about what's happening, and as if I, you know, have this big sort of grand design that is sprung from, you know, my vast craft knowledge or whatever, you know, as opposed to just sort of a fervent, urgent desire to try to sit in uncertainty without groping to resolve it, which I think is what writing actually has to teach me, you know. Not to get woo-woo about it, but like, you know, again, like all of the big questions that I have about everything, why I'm here, why I survived when so many like me didn't, I drove drunk a billion trillion times. I drove blackout drunk a billion trillion times. I never had a serious injury, nor did I ever seriously injure anyone, right? Whereas other people may have only ever done that once or twice and like forever indelibly changed the trajectory of their lives, right? And so like, why am I here? And what does it mean that I'm here? And to what do I owe that being here? And what does that imply is incumbent upon me now? And I'm never going to be able to answer any of those questions, you know, I will never have clarity about any of those things. And I think that, I don't know. I mean, I'm really interested in that uncertainty. I also, you know, also not for nothing, you know, I think that, you know, irony is the sort of default posture of the public intellectual or the writer or whatever you want to call it. And, I mean, other people have written about this more cogently than I will be able to sort of clumsily, waltz around. But I think that irony is a position that is only possible if you are used to sort of being on the top of a hegemonic power structure. And if you are used to sort of, if you are able to sort of laugh at yourself, it's because you don't expect everyone else is laughing at you, or you don't expect everyone else is condescending to you, right? It's almost as if to say, like, you know, oh, these vast riches or whatever, you know, are meaningless to me, and you should actually discount them. Or it's like that sort of self-effacing thing that, you know, the powerful might do. And I'm not saying irony is unique to America, but I am saying that the skepticism of earnestness, and I mean like actual earnestness. There's like the earnestness that passes for earnestness on Twitter, which is this sort of tactical exchange of non-secret secrets, you know, that or like takes that inhabit the carapace of revolutionary rhetoric, but that actually no one would ever disagree with, you know? And there's that sort of earnestness. And then there's like the actual earnestness that is sort of disarming and also distrusted in literary circles or in academic circles or whatever. And whereas like, I just went to Assisi a couple days ago and visited the Basilica of St. Francis, right? And there were pilgrims there who had traveled so far to visit this temple where, you know, St. Francis is one of the like main dudes in Catholicism, which, you know, I'm not any flavor of Catholic or Christian, but I can still be moved by a, you know, an ancient basilica. And people had traveled a great length to be really, really seriously contemplative and unselfconsciously contemplative. And I was so humbled by the lack of self-consciousness of their serious meditation, you know? Like there was no regard for like if any that thing that I do, you know, where I wanna say, I wanted to call this I'm like just getting really real. I wanted to call this book God. Pilgrim Belt. I Whoa. Was gonna call it. Yeah, I just
that
love
would
those,
have been
like,
such a bold thing to do.
Yeah, I know. I really wanted to. I just love like sort of monolithic monosyllable titles like Crush and Please and Split by Kathy Lynn Shea. You know, these are some of my favorite poetry book titles. You know, Jericho's book and Richard Sykin's book. And I've just always really loved that monolithic monosyllable. And since so much of this book, this new book, orbits spiritual yearning and God, which, you know, when I say God, I mean I'm gesturing up towards the sky right now with waving arms. You can't see, but that's what I mean when I say the word. You know, it's like a tidy little monosyllable that means like, you know, the my grandmother's and justice and poetry and my cats and the bearded man in heaven who gets mad when I lie. And you know, it means all of those things at different times and sometimes all at once to me. And I'm not offended by calling it God. You can call it whatever, you can call it the universe or the cosmos. You know, a lot of the book is sort of orbiting, just thinking about the vertigo of that thought, and just as if I had written a book about like horses and called it Horses, I thought it would be a good title to call this book God. But everyone nobody liked that. Nobody liked that title except for me. But I like Pilgrim Bell has grown on me. But just to say, it's an example of like that thing, right? Of like beginning to say divination and then being like, well, I wouldn't want people to get the wrong idea, you know? But it's the right idea. Like, that's actually the idea that I want people to have.
I wanted to go back, though, to something you said that I really loved about how in writing you get to engage all of the things that you, uncertainty, like getting to sit in the uncertainty of all the questions that you know you'll never have answers to, but they're still questions that you want to engage. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know if uncertainty is something that you find particularly difficult. Like, are you a writer because that's a hard thing for you and writing is part of your spiritual practice of like learning?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a beautiful, beautiful question. I think that lyric poetry, especially for me, seems to be about this kind of orbital movement of language, right? Which is to say, language that, instead of passing directly through its aboutness, sort of circles it without ever moving directly through, which the poet Alan Grossman said that a poem is about a thing the way a cat is about a house. And I've always kind of, isn't that great? I've always kind of loved that. But, you know, if I was writing a poem about my grandfather, and my, you know, my grief that my grandfather has passed. And I said, you know, the last memory I have of my grandfather was when I was 2 years old and walking with him in his garden and helping him water his tomatoes. And now he's dead. And it's so dreary, him being dead. You know, isn't it sad that he's dead? Bear witness to my gloom. That's like one way of writing a poem that's like very, very like an arrow shot through the aboutness, right? Like it's super, super linear, like directly about the thing, right? Whereas I think that most poems tend to move more like, the last memory I have of my grandfather is when I was 2 years old and helping him water tomatoes in his garden. And last night I went on a Tinder date with this hedge fund manager who wouldn't stop talking about the Brooklyn Nets, and it was insufferable. And he ordered tomato soup, and I started bawling right there at the table, and I was sobbing too hard to explain why, right? Like that, that's a much more, I'm sorry for like the like sort of impromptu, you know, I mean, I'm sure that hopefully you understand what I'm getting at, but like it moves more orbitally, right? It's not like, bear witness to my gloom about my grandfather. It's about the thing sort of like inflecting the living.
I like the descriptor orbital too, that it's trying to move around. I just also just always love spatial metaphors and space metaphors. When talking about writing, that's kind of how my brain defaults as well. But I like the way that that's like, it implies that you're moving around a thing, not to circumvent it, but because you're pulled by it.
Yeah. And there's like this gravitational force of the thing. And when you stray too far from it, it pulls you back in. And there's this kind of centripetal movement implied by it. I mean, you do nonfiction. I feel like a lot of contemporary nonfiction, and I, you know, you would be more interesting to speak to this than me, but I feel like a lot of contemporary nonfiction moves this way too, right?
I think so. Some of the contemporary nonfiction that I find like the most exciting and inspiring does the same. And yeah, I definitely find that metaphor apt for thinking about the way that it feels when I write too. It's often writing feels like circling a gravitational center. Often though, I don't always know what the thing is that I'm circling. I just know it because I can feel I'm being pulled. And then hopefully eventually by the end, I can see what the thing is, what my planet is. But it's about being like drawn by that pull and just trying to follow it, rather than, not to beat this metaphor to death, but like go straight through it, go linearly through it, which would just ruin it.
Yeah, totally, totally. It goes back to what you were talking about earlier about discovery, right? And that orbital movement leads you to places that you wouldn't go if you were sort of just like plotting a linear movement through a thing, right? That linear movement is what we use when we, are sort of cold calling people to turn out the vote, or when we're, doing brochures, or, like that's the sort of, like rhetorical appeals where that sort of thinking is useful. But I feel like in any sort of interesting literary writing, we want to feel like we're being present with that. We want to feel present to that experience of creation or discovery happening, right?
Yeah. Otherwise, I don't know. I know that there are people who can walk into a thing, of the process of making a thing, and already know how it's going to go and what's going to happen at the end of it. But I just cannot imagine wanting to bother if you knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that those people are like journalists, right? Or again, like persuasive writers and whatever, persuasive writers in whatever form.
Sure, that makes sense.
I also think that, when we're talking about, writing around the unknowable, there's sort of like a parallel thread between that and writing about ethics, or writing about like what it means to be good in America in 2021, where we're all kind of fucked and there's no ethical consumption under late capitalism, and we're all sort of compromised and subject to the sort of corrosive moral influence of empire, right? And I think a lot of people are writing really interestingly around how to navigate that. And a lot of people are really tearing themselves apart around these ideas. And I think that the goodness towards which we are moving is horizontal. You march towards it forever and you never actually get there, like the horizon, and it's the movement that keeps us good. But I also think that because it is a movement, it is like an ongoing process and not a destination, that it makes the destination unknowable as the horizon is sort of unknowable or unchartable, right? And so I think that the inquiry along the lines of thinking around unknowability and sitting in uncertainty also makes me more able to sit in that sort of horizontal process of like learning to move through the world without harming it, and getting like a little bit better at that every day, or trying to get a little bit better at that every day. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's interesting. Also, a lot of the language you just used to me rings a bell in my ear, because it sounds similar to language I've heard other people use about sobriety, that it's a horizontal thing that you're constantly moving within and toward and never quite arrived, and that becoming okay with that is part of the process.
Yeah, that's a really, I had never put, I'd never sort of so directly correlated one with the other, but you're right, I think that thinking deeply about sobriety as an ongoing daily process and not as like, oh, I'm sober, what's the next thing, but as an ongoing process that will continue for, until it doesn't continue one way or the other. has allowed me again, to sit in the idea of asymptotic practice, right? Like practice that approaches a limit without ever actually arriving at it, right? I am no less an addict today than I was 8 years ago. I just have better coping mechanisms, right? And a lot of the obsessions and compulsivities have sort of sublimated into other obsessions and compulsivities, most of these ones today orbiting writing and reading and which are a little bit easier on my liver.
Hopefully a lot easier though.
It's hard
sometimes. Writing feels manifestly bad for my body, so we'll see.
Oh, totally. Yeah, my an elder in recovery always used to say, quit things in the order they're killing you, right? When I got sober, I kept smoking for a long time afterwards. I was a pack and a half a day smoker, and eventually I was able to quit that too, right? And the writing, insofar as it's, it will certainly cause me to lose sleep, it will certainly cause me to neglect other elements that might be more directly related to my health. But in terms of like quitting things in the order they're killing me, I think I have a lot of other things that I can pay attention to before I turn to the writing.
How did the practice of sobriety, and we were already sort of touching on this, how did the practice of sobriety teach you the practice of writing, or did it?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the most direct and honest way is just that it gave me time, right? It gave me, when I was still drinking and using, I drank about being a writer. I didn't really write, I told people that I was a writer, but I didn't really write. And when I got sober, I threw away everything that I'd written prior to getting sober. It was all sort of this bad stand up, it's like sort of like just bad stand up routines. I don't know. I want to say that's the biggest thing. I mean, I think that everyone's fear when they start to think about goodness or whatever, in whatever form that takes in your life. For me, it meant, getting sober and then also beginning to think about what role I might be playing in the universe and how to maybe make that more useful for non-me people. And I think that everyone fears that, they're going to receive some sort of St. Francis version of that, which is like, sell everything that you own and live in a monastery, or, like that is the only sort of logical end to goodness, right? To be truly rigorously good, one would sort of denounce all worldly, so on and so forth, and just sort of, live with their mule on a hill or something, which, is not without its charm.
But then you have to find a mule, then you have to find a hill.
Yeah.
It's a lot to it.
It's a lot to it. A lot to it. But I think that, I don't know. I mean, I'm a better husband when I'm writing and when I'm thinking about this stuff. I'm a better friend, and I'm a better fellow in recovery to the newcomers with whom I work, and I'm a better son and a better uncle and a better teacher. I mean, it just, the more engaged I am in thinking about this stuff, I can feel it. Like my spouse can tell, like, when I've been neglecting this work, right? And by this work, I mean all of it, right? The the poems were such a big part of my sobriety process, especially early on, like just literally, right? Like, you know, a piece of driftwood to which I was desperately clinging to after the ship sank. You talk about avoiding facile metaphors. I'm talking about the ship sinking, but you know, it was just literally like this thing to which I was clinging. And now, you know, I have a little bit more time under my belt, and I'm able to look a little bit past my own sort of all-encompassing psychopathologies, you know? And I think that that's the difference between the first book and the second book, you know, is just the first book was like me out there on the water, and this new book feels a little bit more like being washed up on the sand and being like, oh shit, like what now? You know? I don't know. I'll probably hate that description of it tomorrow, but that's the truth that it seems to me today.
Yeah. I want to take a second to talk about Pilgrim Bell, the God book. One question I had for you about this book is about the repetition of the Pilgrim Bell.
Yeah.
And how you came to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for spending time with the book. I appreciate that. I haven't talked to a lot of people who have read it yet. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, time is your most irreplenishable resource on this planet. And so I'm grateful to you for giving me some of it.
It's so good, Kaveh. It's really, really so spectacular. It was like my joy to get to spend time with it.
I appreciate that. The Pilgrim, I think there are six Pilgrim Bell poems in the book. And they have a sort of funny form. They have this form where they're kind of aggressively punctuated. There are periods where there don't necessarily need to be grammatical periods in the sentence, or where the enjambment might already be implying a period, or even more often where the enjambment is implying that there wouldn't be a period, but then there will still be a period at each line break. Which, I mean, it does a lot for me, I think. Not to sound too sort of highfalutin. I feel like you can't put a G on faluting. Like,
no, because then you're faluting highly.
Yeah, it's highfalutin.
Yeah,
but like, that's funny. I never thought about that. You would never say highfaluting. Not to sound too highfalutin about it, but I think that, again, in a book that is so much about me trying to teach myself to sit in uncertainty without trying to resolve it, the period is sort of the grammatical demarcation of certainty, right? It is saying like, this is the end of the thought unit, right? And this is an enclosed unit that follows this like received order of subject, verb, object, right? And the periods in those poems, in the Pilgrim Bell poems, don't denote that, right? They're an attempt to impose that kind of order, that kind of certainty on a poem, but the poem resists them, right? Like a sentence will go on past the period, as if the period wasn't there. And in so doing, I think, was a useful little practice for me in thinking about like my own sort of impotent attempts to impose certainty on, or to like name things in my own living that are unnameable or that resist that kind of demarcation. I also think that, you know, the book is called Pilgrim Bell. All of those poems are called Pilgrim Bell. And I think about the chiming of the bell as you know, the bell, like the big church bell or the big bell at the center of the town, right, is a technology that requires the weight of a human body in order to make it sound, right? Like you have to like pull on the rope with your I'm pantomiming this. You can't see me, but like, but you have to pull on the weight of the rope in order to make the bell move. And you have to make the bell move in order to make a sound. Right. And so, it's the heft of the human body that moves the bell, which is this devotional technology, which strikes me as very poignant, right? The idea of like needing to use this like weird dying spacesuit that we have, in order to apprehend something that is completely not of the body, right? Or that does not live in the body. I think that that's really, really trenchant. And so there's something in the chiming of the bell and those periods and the and how the sound of the bell doesn't have like a finite endpoint, right? Like it just sort of chimes until you can't hear it, but someone else might still be able to hear it, right? And so again, you have the periods trying to impose that order on language that resists it, or the periods trying to say this is the end of the chime, when the language is saying no, it isn't. Does this make sense? I feel like I'm rambling now.
No, it makes perfect sense. It made me go and look up if a pilgrim bell is a thing, because it sounds like it would be, you know, like it sounds like it could be a real artifact in the world. And then I kind of loved that it wasn't, you know, that I couldn't find it, because it made me think then the next image I had was of the body of the pilgrim being the bell, and the emptiness of the body of the pilgrim being sort of like struck and resonant. Maybe that's just because you, in one of the early poems, I think it's the third, the poem, The Miracle, talk about what was empty in the man, and Gabriel squeezing him away. And like you were just talking about sort of the empty spaces inside us being, being resonant, even as they are sort of painful.
Totally. It's the emptiness that makes the sound. I mean, later on in the book, there's a poem called My Father's Accent, where I tell this parable about the devil inspecting Adam, and he sort of like gives Adam the up and down, and then he enters Adam's mouth and passes through all of his body and passes through his guts and emerges out his anus, and he emerges and he's all excited because he's like, oh, you know, man is hollow. It's all emptiness, you know, like this is going to be easy. Like all I have to do is show man something, you know, these things that he's going to want to fill himself with. And, you know, and it'll be easy to sort of like persuade him over to my side, because he's just going to want to try to fill himself his whole life. Right. And I feel like that's the story of this man, you know, that's the story of me, whether I've tried to fill myself with narcotics or alcohol or poetry or praise or art or money or sex, you know, I there's not a thing on this world that feels good that I haven't made myself sick off of. And that emptiness, right? I feel like that emptiness, instead of trying to resolve it and fill it and drown it, you know, learning to sit with that, right, it's the whole journey.
Thresholds is a production of Lit Hub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber. Special thanks to Farrar Strauss and Drew. I'm Jordan Kistner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kistner. We'll see you next week.